Stoner comics, a nebulous category of comics that contain both comics about stoners and comics for stoners, often... Oh boy, that sentence doesn't make sense. Oh, it does kind of make sense. It's just... Okay. I'm sorry, I'm stoned right now.
Yeah. Really?
Stoner comics. No, I actually... I mean, that'd be like
a fun recording. You would have to warn me in advance because my friend, yeah, I don't have anything at my place, but my friend has some, so I could have arranged that.
I consider we have a bunch of gummies because it's legal here, and I like considered nibbling on one like right before we started, so it would kick in like half an hour in, and then I was like, I don't love getting. We'll probably talk about it. I don't love getting stoned, and sometimes it's very easy for me to shift into too stoned, and then it might just ruin the episode. So I didn't want to do it. Okay.
I mean, and you know, like I don't know that I would get in trouble, but it is illegal here, so I don't know if it's a good idea for me to record myself saying I'm high.
All right, I'm leaving all this in, so you are arrested. Stoner comics, a nebulous category of comics that contain both comics about stoners and comics for stoners, oftentimes both. These comics often have simple narratives, hangout vibes, and lowbrow humor, and are easy for someone who's been sampling that kind to read. But with that perhaps unflattering description, what is there to recommend this style of comic? Join us in our discussion this month on Extra Issues.
Hello and welcome to Extra Issues, the Comic Book Reading Club podcast where we choose a theme and read through a selection of comics that explore that theme. Our current theme is the alternative comic book publisher Fantagraphics, and this month we are discussing Meg Morgan Owl, Prison Pit, and Dungeon Quest. I'm Charlotte, and I am currently recording this episode with a mic attached to a sloppy dildo left here by my werewolf neighbor. And today, I'm joined by a very special co-host. You might know him better by his nickname of Digestible Scrotum. It's Zach Dean. How's it going, Zach?
Digestible scrotum is really funny, like just a nickname for something that it's like, yeah, sure, of course,
very probably digestible
most,
scrotum
probably most scrotum extra digestible scrotum, thank you very much. I need to be distinguished somehow. I'm good, I'm really excited to talk about this, and the more because I came up with this category, so just to like put it out there, I like made this category up for a way to smush together a bunch of comics I wanted to talk about. I think Meg Morgan Owl and Dungeon Quest are like pretty clearly stoner comics. I think they fit really well into that category. Prison Pit, I think I have to justify a little bit, and I will, or at least I'll try. And but I'm the more I read these, the more I kind of felt like, okay, this works. This works as like a category in and of itself.
And, even you know, closer in vibe than anything else we've read for Fantagraphics so far.
Well, that's something I'm gonna like. I really want to talk about is that I can really clearly see the lineage between these comics like 8-Ball and like especially 8-Ball and like a little Love and Rockets. Like, you know, it does feel like influences are here for sure. I felt heartened today because I was looking it up when I was writing the intro, which wasn't much of anything, but I was looking up a like, you know, categories of stoner comics, and it's not really like a talked about genre necessarily, except for like stoner web comics, I guess. But if you type in stoner comics, I think like the second result on Google will be Fantagraphics website giving you recommendations for their stoner comics. And it's really funny. They actually do. They recommend like weed strain pairings with different comics.
Really, so they're fun, like,
it's really funny. They're like, oh, you might enjoy this with a nice Northern Lights or with this one with a Purple Haze or whatever. Okay, so you're in a country where it's pretty illegal. I don't want you to get in trouble for this, so don't feel like you have to get into your history with illegal drugs. It is legal here. I'm also not going to get too much into it, but like mostly because I don't really partake anymore. It's just I kind of wore myself out on weed when I was like 20.
Yeah.
And but like I actually, I'm very curious because I don't think you you lived... the stoner lifestyle, which I definitely did when I was like 19 to 21, 22, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was deep into COVID when I was that age, so yeah, would have been hard.
So I am curious to compare our like experiences with these comics, because I found like a lot of this deeply relatable in a way, which I think is
prison
pits, you know,
especially relatable.
Yeah, right.
Like, that's
yeah, that
straight
was,
out of
that's
your,
my 20s all over. Yeah, exactly. But before we do any of that, I want to ask, what are your favorite terms for getting stoned?
My favorite what?
Like, do you have terms? Do you have slang in French?
Like, oh,
okay. So for example, like when I was, you know, when I was a young kid, we used to just always say that, you know, when you get high, you're stony baloney, you know?
Stony baloney.
Or,
okay.
that we didn't. That's like 1960s. Like, that. I was thinking about it and I was like, what kind of terms did we use a lot? And I think it was just like baked or, you know, fucked up or I don't know.
Stoned. Kind of the same. We don't have like an equivalent.
Maybe zooted. Sometimes people would use zooted kind of winkingly a little bit.
We don't really have an equivalent of high that is like not like
what about
that's just like a normal word for it, but it's neither clinical nor like an insult, quote unquote, or like not an insult but like vulgar, right?
Sure.
So
I would say je suis défoncé.
Yeah, exactly, which is like just fucked up basically.
yeah,
being fucked up. That's like that's the yeah. That's what people would say. Just fucked up. Or they don't say yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Was that straight up Google's Translate or?
No, I was like looking for like slang terms because I was like, I wonder what the kids say today, which is surprisingly hard to find. Just like a listicle of, and that like weirdly popped up. Like, what do the French say for this? And I was like, oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So here's something to start this out. I actually think stoner humor is terrible. Okay. So like stoner
good
comedy.
Start,
if you're, yeah. The thing is, I don't think this fits in with mainstream stoner like comedies.
What would
stuff.
You call stoner humor?
Grandma's like movies like Grandma's Boy or Half Baked or.
I have to look that up pretty quickly.
Pineapple. Pineapple Express probably is one of the more recent ones, or like, boy, I don't know, do they even make stoner comedies anymore? Like, it definitely was a thing that was like much more American Ultra, I guess, was that a little bit? Yeah, where like the joke often is like, isn't it funny to get really blazed and then, you know, like laugh?
Yeah. Is like The Hangover, would you consider The Hangover to be a stoner?
No, because that's, I mean, that's kind of a, literally a, like, alcohol comedy, I guess.
I don't know, I've never seen any of the things you're talking about. The Hangover.
Jay and Silent Bob?
Ooh, that I know.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's literally, like, where weed is a central role in it, but, like,
yeah
sometimes it's, I mean, like, some of those movies have stuff to recommend them. I don't want to, like, trash them overall. Dude, Where's My Car? I don't know if you saw that. That one has some funny stuff. But, like,
sorry.
Stoner humor, like, if you're in that world, is often pretty lame, and it's also very, like, just, what's the word? Like, pandering to stoners of just, you know, like, haha, isn't it funny to be stoned, and it's fun and funny. And I actually kind of think these comics get away from that, especially the two explicitly stoner comics, in a way that I appreciate. So they don't actually feel like they fit in with, like, what I would consider, like, mainstream stoner humor.
But because they don't necessarily target, I mean, at least, like, in to me, it didn't feel like they targeted specifically a stoner audience. Maybe Dungeon Quest more, but like Meg Morgan Owl just feels like it's about stoner characters, but it doesn't feel like it's trying to pander or even like just identify to a stoner audience.
Because it's way too
because they're all the worst people in the world.
I felt like more despair like in my chest reading Meg Morgan Owl than I have for any media in a long time. Like, for these characters, I think I found it like deeply relatable, and it like made me like existentially worried for my younger self.
Oh boy.
Who was like not in this exact situation, not nearly as dire, but like dancing around it. And like, yeah. So let's hold off we can talk about each of these one at a time. Yeah. Before we do, though, I do want to mention, I think all three of these comics get into some pretty gnarly stuff. So, like, specifically, we're going to be talking about, like, sexual assault. I think that's probably the big one that just want to give people, like, a heads up. That's, I think, in all three of these comics in a big way. And handled in, like, a pretty glib way, which, you know, I'm not even damning in the comics. I think it's trying to, they're all going for their own aesthetic, and it's very, it plays fast and loose with some stuff, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But, like, we're going to be talking about it, so just a forewarning. Okay, do you want to start with, I kind of want to start with Prison Pit, just since I think it's, the slightest of the three.
Yeah, fair enough.
It is written by Johnny Ryan. It was done from 2009 to 2018, which I thought was really interesting. It is like 700 pages, the entire thing. You can read it in about 1 hour, the whole thing. It's on Hoopla, if you're looking for it.
Yeah, just six issues. Which are like six individual books, kind of. In the way, like, I wasn't clear if it was like six issues, like six volumes, kind of. Mm-hmm. In the like European
They're volumes.
Style.
Yeah, they weren't issues. Yeah, because I actually... A little background and motivation for this category. Both Prison Pit and Dungeon Quests were books on the shelf of a dealer I had back in, like, I don't know, 2004 or something. While I was, like, dating his roommate.
And this then, like, this episode selection of comics is brought to you by Zach's dealer from 15 years ago.
Yeah, shout out Carl. Thank you. Incredible. Like, Meg Wong and Owl I just discovered for the first time, but the other two I had read for the first time sitting on their couch and, like, picking those off the shelf and being like, wow, what are these? And both of them, I kind of, when I was, like, in my early 20s, I was a little squeamish about both these books, and now I, like, really embrace them, but both of them, like, kind of felt really edgy and shocking to me, which is interesting, because now they do slightly, but I was a little bit more prudish then, I think. Prison Pit, I think it's interesting that it took 9 years to come out. It feels so... I think it's easy to think that it is a... Like, it's so scratchy, and it's so, like, kind of messy on purpose that it feels like it could be so easy just to churn it out, I think.
Yeah, but there is... I think there is a good balance of... Not restraints. Restraint is definitely not the right word, but it is clean enough in just the, like, the way pages and panels are, like, conceived, that, like, you it is very easy to read through and, like, have a clear sense of what's going on, despite how messy what's going on is. And I think there is something, like, there is something quite kind of impressive in that, because, like, on theory, like, I was expecting something way messier on, like, a structural level, or, like, on a, the word, on a...
Like, formal or...
Yeah, visual? Formal, thank you. Like, on a formal level. And I think this is quite clean on a formal level in a way that helps it not get too tiring.
Maybe not restrained is the word, but, like controlled?
Control, right?
I think that's a good point, because it's weirdly, like... Like, one of the best action comics I've ever read, where, like, it's 90% just fighting, right? But, like, it's always, and it's all just about creative violence. I mean, that's the, I guess for people who haven't read it or who might be curious, it's just about this weird guy, kind of a goblin man.
Say the name.
What's his name? I don't remember his name.
It's something fuckface, right?
Oh, yeah. God, that's right. I totally
Again, I don't remember what the first name is, but his last name is Fuckface, right? Yeah. Johnny Fuckface or something? I don't remember.
Yeah, sure. Cannibal Fuckface.
Cannibal Fuckface, that's it.
Yep.
Johnny Fuckface is funnier to me.
Johnny Fuckface is funnier. Yeah. He gets dropped off in, like, a Mad Max post-apocalypse world where everyone's, like, a mutant, including him. And with very, very little, like... exposition, there's extremely little, like, explaining of the world, but it gets so much across visually in just how, like, these people move and operate, like, physiologically. But I think the action is always, like, crystal clear, where I'm like, okay, then he suplexes him and his neck hits a rock and breaks, and then, like, you just understand the violence that's happening Because sometimes it will be like, here's a move, and it will do three panels to show this specific, like, you know, arm ripping off, or someone getting stabbed through in a specific way, or whatever. So, like, I think it's a great action comic. I kind of think, you know, it's... Marvel Comics can't do this, because they have 22 pages to do a whole story, and they often don't want to spend the amount of space it takes to do, like, really well-defined action. But it's really, it's kind of fun and exciting to see it done this way, where, like, you just get carried along and your eyes just zip over the panels and you're like, next page, next page, next page, and you're just following, like, a fight. And it's just, like, wrestling move, punch, you know, someone getting impaled, someone getting their head cut off, et cetera, et cetera. Someone jerking off a little, just a little fucked up gremlin jerking off until their cum makes a giant goblin
slime monster
that,
yeah.
that they ride inside of. To fight cannibal fuckface.
That's really good. There's an animated adaptation of the first book, and that's part of that, and that's it is what you're saying about the fights and like the not the choreography, but like how dynamic and clear it is. Like I'm watching the animated version, I was like, oh, this is just the comic, and yet it's very like. It's very clean animation, like very clean in that, like it's very fluid animation, and like it's very clear what's going on. And like that's, I'm not surprised that it worked. Like it was very easy to adapt. I mean, easy.
Is that like an Adult Swim thing? Do you think?
I have no idea. I just watched it on YouTube. I don't know where it comes from.
It seems like it would be. Yeah,
might be. Yeah, but like the animation was really impressive, and it is. I do think part of it is a testament to how good the action is in the comic and how clear it is. Like the just the like the two first pages are eight panels of like a a huge like dick shaped robotic thing plunging into a deep hole in the earth and it's slowly getting down
immediately and, setting the tone.
But like that's like the sequence of action is like very like it's a long moment that takes eight panels in two pages, and like the action is really clear, and like that it's just that for two pages, and like that's now how I imagine that comic to begin, right? Like it begins with a like a dick joke, but a very clean and like well drawn dick joke, right? Like a formalistically impressive dick joke.
I agree, and like I mean, I think that's something all these comics do pretty well is like, well, Megmog and Owl might not be, but this and Dungeon Quest both use like negative space really well, like lots of just empty white space to contrast their designs. There's very little dialogue in this, which I think is good. I went back and read a little bit of Johnny Ryan's early stuff, Angry Youth Comics, which feels like someone who went and read 8-Ball and was like, well, that is not offensive enough. Let me make 8-Ball. Let me do 8-Ball, but like make it considerably more aggressive and offensive, which is kind of a wild task. And it's I didn't give it a fair shot, but I read like half the first issue and I was like, this is miserable. So I kind of appreciate, and it was just about like a guy who moves through the world being like hateful and angry.
Yeah, because that what you were telling me before we started recording that it's like just. It gets like widely anti-Semitic and stuff like that. Like it gets nasty in like real world ways instead of just like exaggerated violence, right?
Which I didn't give it like a shot enough to, you know, see what it's doing with that, you know, like how much it's, what it's saying with that. It could just be anti-Semitic or not. I don't want to just come down that strongly, but yeah, it seemed kind of bad to start. I mean, this like definitely is trying to like, this is trying to make, you know, have like this juvenile maximal like extreme as it gets, or extreme as it like wants to get with like the violence and dicks and just violence and assaultive actions and stuff. It doesn't really often veer into somewhere where I'm actually offended. You mentioned it in our notes here. Like he definitely he throws out the N-word once in a way that feels
and some
like
homophobic slurs. Yeah, he's just trying there. Yeah,
but I like, mean a lot of homophobic slurs all throughout all three of these comics. For
yeah,
sure.
Absolutely. It is like it is even weirder because this is the N-word felt like especially out of place because this is a world where like people aren't really humans, no, no and no one human. Is like yeah, identifiable yeah. to like real life skin colors or anything. Yeah. Like, so it's like yeah, really yeah. weird in other places. Like, why does that word even exist in this world? Right? Yeah, yeah. Was like the homophobic slugs, like, okay, that's of a piece with the, yeah. Yeah, but
yeah, the hyper masculine,
yeah, like, exactly,
aggression of this.
Same thing yeah. with like, there's a character that has like underwear with a swastika on it, which is like, yeah, okay, that's of a piece with
see, kind of stuff. See, even that kind of fits in with just the angry 16-year-old who's just trying, yeah. like, sketching this in their sketchbook and just being, you know, trying to give a middle finger to like anyone who. Would be uncomfortable with this, like trying to make the adults uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah, but like that's, I feel like that's not what the rest of the book is. To me, like the rest of the book was very much Looney Tunes, but with actual blood. Like, with that, what if the Looney Tunes didn't have like cartoon physics, right?
yeah, I mean, I guess, but also with like where the funniest thing in the world is like also just like boners and vaginas yeah. and come right, like, I mean, all that stuff is
yeah, it was very funny that
it sometimes sometimes it is funny,
like, it is sometimes funny, like the fact that he basically, the character loses an arm in the first issue and he like his arm gets replaced by like a weird slime monster, like kind of like venom, like
a slug,
but like it's like venom or it's kind of a symbiote that like he fuses with, and so now his hand is now just like the weird face of a monster. And he's like, the monster hand is like licking his blood and everything and slowly goes down to his crotch and starts just like sucking him off. That was quite funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it kind of gets by on never flinching away from it and like always upping the, like, by the end of this, like, it actually got funnier and funnier to me as it went on, just because of like, like, its commitment to just doing one, like, it really is just one thing, trying to do it, like, really purely. Like, it's such a pure expression of this, like, mutant violence thing. So, like, by the end, when, like, when he, here's some examples. He fights a guy named Undigestible Scrotum, who's got both a vagina, and then he's got these like big spiky balls hanging down, but then out of his vagina comes like a chain hook that he uses to attack, and then the cannibal fuckface rips off his spiky balls, chews them up, is definitely like not having a good time, he's like foaming at the mouth eating his balls, and then shits out like spiky turds and then throws it in his face, and then the guy goes, you digested my scrotum. Like, that's the level of comedy, but that made me laugh really hard.
So I'm like, as you're thinking about it, as we're speaking about it, I'm like realizing, I mean, I'm wondering, why does this work for me but Garth Ennis doesn't, right? Because in theory, like, the level of humor in The Boys is similar to this, right? But that's a question I'm asking to you as well as myself.
Yeah,
like,
why
do The Boys don't work for me and this does, right? That's a weird thing.
Maybe this, like, because this is not ever trying to also tug at your heartstrings, right? Yeah. This is never trying to like really tell a real story.
Yeah.
And it also, I think it's more committed to the joke. Shock stuff. I think it's a little bit more, it's a little less winky and more screaming.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, some of the jokes, like him getting sucked off by his like symbiote thing, that feels like that could be a joke Mark Miller wrote in like an Ultimate Venom comic, but like it pans away, like it implies it, and that would kind of annoy me. But like here, just going through with it, like that's funnier,
and doing it slowly over like four panels and just watching it happen. Like, putting so much care and attention into these juvenile jokes. Like, the last fight scene of this, he has encased himself in crystal armor, and his boner is, like, 2 feet long, and his middle fingers are, like, a foot long each, and he's just killing everybody both with his crystal-sharp boner and flipping everybody off with the middle finger at the same time. Including, at one point, knocking someone down, doing a belly flop onto them with his boner impaling their head and then spinning in place on his boner with his middle fingers out and just like slicing everybody in half around him.
Yep.
Like, that kind of commitment to showing that in detail and drawing that like so detailed really gets me. some guy in the prison trying to like rape him from behind and like putting his dick in his butt. And then Cannibal Fuckface squeezing his butt cheeks and pulling his dick off with his butt and then shitting his dick back at him. Like, that's that kind of hyper commitment to just being as, like, gross. Like, I really, I can hear myself saying this.
Yeah.
And people being like, well, that sounds really stupid. And it, like, it really is.
It is.
It's a very lowbrow sense of humor, but I think it's that, like, it is. It's just that commitment to purely express that and to try to keep, like, upping the ante here in this stuff keeps it, like, kind of engaging and funny, and, like, and it's just long enough, right? Like, it takes about an hour to read the whole thing, and by the end, like, I was done and I'm not hungry really for more of this, but, like,
no,
it's really its own thing. I don't know much else that's doing this kind of thing, and I appreciate, like, something that just feels, you know, like it's exists. God, Cat Jaculate.
Jaculate, really, you really like that one.
That one's really funny. The villain being like, oh, we've been successful, time to relax with some cat jaculate, and then, like, a poor little shriveled up cat in a jar with a like IV needle coming out of its dick. And the guy just, like, inserting it in his arm and going like, ah, cat jaculate.
Yeah, I mean, like, it is
I hope my mom, like, doesn't listen to this episode. She's been tell me what your podcast is. I'm going to listen to an episode.
This is the one she lands on. She gives a chance. I mean, it is, like you said, the commitment to the jokes. And, like, it is full of, like, visual jokes that you wouldn't get if you're just looking at the like, if you're just looking at the text here, you're going to have a miserable time. Like, everything once is in a while, in the visuals, like, which is very fun and rare for us in, like, a Marvel podcast thing.
True,
right?
Yeah. So, like, sometimes the language that he uses will, like, tickle me, because it's all just very, like, teenage boy vulgar stuff. You know, like, I'm looking at a page right now and it's the villain being like, look, look at you crawling on the floor like a stupid baby. You can't escape from me, you pathetic turd. You're like a wet shit rag. Just stuff like that. Like,
it is very much like a teenager, like an edgy teenager writing a comic that's, like, actually being made by a competent comic artist. Which is fun. I can say.
But he was, like, older than me when he started doing this. Yeah. Right? So he was, like, 37 or something. But, like we said, there's a real, like, formal mastery of, like, this exact thing going on here. So, like, yeah, it's very impressive. And I kind of came away surprised at how much I like this. And I included this being like, Prison Pit's fine. Like, I think it's interesting to talk about. But, like, now I'm like, all right, I think maybe I got to buy this. Maybe I got to put this one on my shelf.
Yeah. Well, because it feels like, I think something I was afraid of, kind of, is, like, the writer from, like, other stuff, from, like, other pages of stuff I've seen him do, is, like, seems to be someone that, like, thrives on, like, being offensive for the sake of being offensive and having people respond to that, right?
Yeah.
And this doesn't feel like it. Like, there are one or two moments, like we said, like the gratuitous N-word and stuff like that, and, like, some scenes of sexual assault, but that are, like, so weird and unreal that it's like, yes, if you view that through real-world context, it's sexual assault, but it's so, like, weird and doesn't make sense because the rules of the world are so different that it doesn't register as that necessarily. Doesn't mean that it can't be triggering, because very much, like, that's still sexual assault. But, like, it is... Where am I going with this? it is not... I don't think it's an offensive comic for the most part. It's just, like, it's gross, but it's not offensive. It's just, like...
I mean, it's only offensive if you know, kind of just find, like, it being crude. It's very crude. It's extremely crude. And if you find
I guess, like, it's not offensive in the way that, like, people usually say offensive, like, politically or socially offensive, and it's very much not that at all. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you just find this kind of, like, juvenile... crude.
I mean, it's repulsive, not offensive.
And violence. Yeah. I mean, certainly, like, I'm sure if everyone listening to this goes and reads it, we'll have a lot of people turned off by it.
Oh, sure. I'm, you know, like, I'd be surprised if like everyone aesthetically, likes it. But, yeah. I mean, I'm surprised I like it, so, yeah.
Yeah, me too. I'm so glad. I'm glad, like, none of these were, like, miserable to you. All right, we got to move on. We got three whole comics to talk about, and I think that's the least of them, so... let's do Dungeon Quest next, because unfortunately you were not able to read much of Dungeon Quest, you only could find Volume 2.
Yeah, I was only a bit able to find Volume 2, which I do think gave me a taste of what the comic is like, but from other like jokes Zach has talked to me about, I was like, oh, I'm missing some funny stuff here. That's Dungeon Quest sounds cool.
Volume 1, it only has 3 volumes. I think it just got cut off. I can't find much about like the artist, Joe Daly. So I kind of just think maybe it just didn't succeed. So, and it got canceled, which is too bad, because it clearly like had a long runway and had a big plan for this. But, and I ended up actually really, this was another one where I was like, yeah, I read this 15 years ago and kind of liked it. But 15, 12, 13, I don't know. Doesn't matter. Liked it, but didn't love it. And this time I was like, oh, actually, this is great. Like, I really, really like this. Dungeon Quest is the other thing I liked about this, and we'll talk about with Megmog and Owl. I think Megmog and Owl in this are two illustrations of like kind of of the stoner lifestyle a little bit, of like a little bit more of what it is to like live as a stoner day to day.
Yeah.
I think Dungeon Quest is much more of a like, hey, that's kind of fun versus it, and it's not all fun, but like mostly like, hey, kind of fun versus Megmog and Owl, where I'm like, miserable, just miserable, horrible, degrading existence.
Yeah.
So like I actually kind of appreciated this as the like counterpoint to Megmog and Owl's, you know, like misery of this life lifestyle. So like the conceit of Dungeon Quest is a party of 4 people. It's Millennium Boy, Steven, what's his name? Lash Penis. Who, I love Lash. I love Lash Penis.
Is it the big
and
guy?
Nerd?
Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah, the big guy.
Big
Lash.
Guy, yeah, I love the big guy.
Yeah,
big
like, they're like, who should we get as a, you know, we need like a fighter in our group. And Millennium Boy's like, let's get Lash. And Steven's like, Lash Penis? And he's like, no, Lash Vagina. Yeah, Lash Penis. Who else? go to get Lash Penis. And Nerd Girl, who, Nerd Girl doesn't do anything and it kind of sucks.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've only read the second volume in which she doesn't talk once. Does she talk in other stuff, or is that just
doesn't talk
thing?
In the first volume, and in the third volume it's weird because it's like she literally doesn't say a word in volume 1 or 2, so you kind of think like there's some point to that, but then in volume 3 she says like 5 sentences, and it's not like notable moments when she speaks up. It's not like where Jay and Silent Bob, where Silent Bob ends up talking like at least once per movie, and it's always because he's got something to say. She'll just be like, thanks for saving me, boys, and then or whatever, or like, pass me that spliff or something. It's kind of strange. So just it kind of made me think of Tiffany when she was what episode did we have her on, or was it, oh no, it wasn't Tiffany, it was Kelly Kaneyama in The Boys, talking about like the like silent Asian woman as a trope.
Yeah,
and I was like, is Nerd Girl Asian? Because if so, that's anyway, it's them doing a like D&D adventure. It kind of has the feel of what it is like playing D&D with like these 4 people, right? It kind of feels like you can filter it through, like if you're sitting at a table with these specific personalities, but it's also mixed with them like really going out in the real world and having this adventure. So it's got this kind of like, I don't want to call it magical realism because that's probably a little too like sophisticated, but kind of like it really is operating on its own wavelength that it's hard to pin down. That like it does capture for me like the like I when I was big into weed, and it was in Maine, like surrounded by forests, so like we would always be like getting stoned and going for like hikes in the woods, and like walking through the woods and finding abandoned buildings and old, you know, fallen train tracks to old like abandoned train cars, and wandering around. And I had a friend who, like, really got sucked into kind of, like, the romantic, adventurous, like, ideal of this kind of stuff. So, like, if we were going to take mushrooms, they would, like, pack a backpack full of, you know, like, food and treats, and bring a little boombox for music so they could play, like, the music to set the mood. And, like, really, like, get into trying to create, like, an aesthetic to the day, right? Yeah. Like, they really did this kind of thing, and it like really captured that kind of like, for me, that middle space of like, you're kind of adults but you're still trying to capture the feeling of like being a kid and, you know, living in your imagination. And for this it's through D&D, right? But like it also has that level of realism, so that's like, it's kind of the big appeal to me. I don't know. What did you think of what you got to read? I feel bad you didn't get to.
No, I mean, it's
and it does just end. It's not like it had a conclusion you missed. So
yeah. I like the because I'm more into D&D than I am into the rest of what those comics are about, for sure. Yeah. So to me, I had fun with it definitely on the D&D side of it. Where in the second book, they all have a weird kind of I don't really know, colonial 18th or 19th century America thing going on with raccoon fur, hats and stuff like that. Kind of Davy Crockett vibes. And then they find...
Right, it has a weird relationship with America because the author is South African.
Yeah.
And you can see that because there's South African slang all over it. They call each other boit, which is Afrikaans. But then, I think you missed it in the first book. They meet a Native American who, kind of gives them a vision quest. sends them on their quest. But then, he undercuts that joke with, he's like, you know, what's up, Chief? Do you want to go on our adventure with us? And he's like, nah, I got a badminton tournament.
Anyway.
So, yes, please, go on.
They all have, that thing, those kind of vibes of costumes and everything, and then they have a fight and get some new loot, and now they have big fantasy medieval golden armor and stuff like that. That's that's just what they look like for the rest of that issue. That's very funny to me.
over the course of
implication,
the inventory changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. The kind of video game implication of if you change your armor, you're gonna look wildly different in a way that's quite funny. In a way that wouldn't make sense in the real world, but because it's D&D / video game, you do that because it gives you better protection. That's very funny to me.
He takes the time to illustrate the character inventories. Screens. But the character sheets where you get to see a list of their inventory and seeing them level up, changing classes every time.
Yeah,
that became basically the only thing I ended up reading on those, was just to see what their new class is every time they end up leveling up.
And then in the second book, they're kind of I don't know if it's the case for the whole thing, but in the second book, they're kind of in a Indiana Jones Tomb Raider style story where they're exploring kind of a hidden tomb in the forest somewhere or something like that. And Millennium Boy, which is the character with the huge head, kind of I'm guessing the nerd character, is explaining the archaeological and historical relevance of the ruins and everything, in a way that's not really made fun of. He's just kind of giving a tour of the thing, like a historical nerd guide. And I was like, oh no, that's me. Oh no, that's that's me.
That's incredible. Okay, so Millennium Boy has he clearly likes being the smartest guy in the room.
Yep.
To a point where it's really funny. There's there's a conceit in this where they keep calling it a charger, which I'm not familiar with that term, but it's just little cap.
Yeah,
it's like a little capsule. That's a butt plug, but they can put stuff in it and hide it, but maybe the name is charger. Lash carries it for a while up his butt, and then later you didn't get to this part later.
He shoots stuff off his butt during a fight and pierces a hole through his pants.
That's really funny. That panel of him leaping down and squatting during his jump, and then the thing just shooting out of his butt. They're like, oh, we should, stash this away for later, just in an emergency. And Lash is like, I don't want to do it anymore. And they're like, oh, well, Steven's unconscious. Let's stick it up his. So they put it up his butt, and then you get five panels watching this thing get slowly sucked up his butthole.
Oh my god.
But it's really funny because they're all amazed because he's unconscious, and they don't push it up, they just start to, and then it goes and gets pulled up his butt.
Muscle memory.
They have this long conversation where Millennium Boy is trying to scientifically hypothesize why it got pulled into his butt, and he's barometric differences, air pressure differences, and Lash keeps getting angrier and angrier because he can't understand and Millennium Boy's getting angrier because he can't explain it stupid enough for Lash to understand. Anyway, so Millennium Boy, I think he likes being the smartest guy in the room. But to me, I've just met a lot of guys like this who, again, shout out Carl, the guy who introduced me to these, who are like very, very smart people, like intelligent people, who then use that intelligence to get really sucked into like pseudoscience, pseudo-academic. So he talks about ley lines and Atlantean anthropology and, you know, like linking up the fact that we had a second moon on Earth with the Garden of Eden and Camelot are really the same in ancient, like it's all this conspiracy yeah. theory stuff, like astrotheology and geomancy and all this yeah, stuff, yeah. but like treated like it's a serious academic pursuit and talked about like it is and held in their mind. And like, to me, it's like, I remember getting pinned down by stoners like this who just like, it's either really exciting to you if you're a really like curious person who's just like, I love a weird character, or it's hell to be cornered yeah. by somebody who just is talking to you about this and your eyes are just like so wide being like, uh-huh, what are you talking about? Like, I'm trapped in a conversation with somebody who lives on another like plane of existence.
I mean, I'm definitely not the thing. Yeah.
Oh no, you're not like that, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because I've definitely had conversation with my roommates about like the constellations and the link to the Herculean myth in Greek mythology or like that kind of stuff, and my roommate's like,
oh my god, uh-huh. It is you.
Yeah, cool, Charlotte. That's no, but it's true. That part's true. It's not like, it's not a conspiracy theory. Yeah. Oh,
boy. So I thought the thing that I thought is that he's kind of making fun of that kind of guy.
Yeah.
Until book three, where he finds something called like the Romish Book of the Dead, which is like a civilization that filled the gaps between the fall of Atlantis and then the beginning of like the Assyrians or something.
Yeah.
And the author
I'm
puts
following.
In, the author
puts I hate
in, like,
that I'm following,
22,
but I'm following.
The author puts in like 22 pages of prose from this book writing like the history of these people, and it's not jokey at all. Like, I kept skimming it and being like, am I missing something here? And it feels like, I'm like, oh no, maybe you're actually like, maybe the author is really fascinated by this stuff.
Yeah, I hate that. It sounds awesome. But like, I want to read that.
Oh my god, it was like, to me, I'm like, this is miserable.
Oh,
like, you know, the like, oh yeah, like the Egyptians actually had, you know, like hover cars, like that kind of
oh okay yeah
ties in with
like
that.
I'm just like,
I mean, it's
like 20
that,
pages but. Of like world building for like a D&D campaign is like the side of yeah. that sounds fun to me, right?
Sure. Yeah. So like, it has all that stuff we're talking about, but then it also just has a sense of humor about these characters, right? And their drug use, I think, is it mines a lot from that. Them getting stoned sometimes is like kind of fun, and sometimes they lose their mind. They find some coke in the woods. Did
oh,
you
yeah.
read this one where
yeah,
Lash
yeah.
Lash goes on this like, Lash is very gentle, like mannered, and is generally very like sweet and simple, just all of a sudden out of nowhere goes on this homophobic tirade and starts like yelling slurs at Steve.
Yeah.
It cracked me up so much of just like, and they're like, sorry Steve, like Lash, we have to put you on the no coke list, like you just can't. but, and they find a weed vending machine in the third book, and they get way too high in that one, and like, I don't know, this one this also feels very 2010, or I don't know actually when this one came out. It feels very of its time of dealing with homosexuality, which it is like, they're all straight, well at least they're all claiming to be straight. But there's this, like, lingering, it's really strange. The book's, like, kind of homoerotic at times. Like, there's images here of Lash, like, emerging from a pool of water where he does an entire splash page of Lash's, like, beautifully muscular, perfect body and genitals. Like
yeah.
a foot, where I'm like it doesn't read as a joke. It's not like, haha, look at this nude guy. But then, like, sometimes the characters are kind of, like, joking about, like, haha, you're gay. Like, that kind of thing, and they're like, well, you're only saying that because you're repressed. And like, if, I mean, it feels very of the time of like people bantering about this and not really
yeah,
feeling comfortable.
And the
to
way
talk
you're
about it.
Describing it feels very Brian Michael Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man, right? Like that kind of like gay
Except
jokes
that,
because
like, we're
now
seeing,
we can talk about it, but
yeah.
like it's still.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, kind of, but then at the same time, like there's just a lot of like penises here that are not used like prison pit. Just for like, haha, aren't dicks funny? Like, Sometimes it's just kind of like the dudes hanging out and talking about each other's dicks and being like, man, you got a great dick, man. Like, that's a beautiful penis. Like, and it's like, and then they tease each other for being gay. So it like, it feels like it has this layer of like men not being able to talk about it and like feeling like they're reverting back to homophobia because none of them, like, it's just not comfortable for any of them yet. And it's like a defense mechanism, but it's like a little bit more in the air. It definitely makes me happier for a time where like gay characters are just more integrated and talked about. And like, not that I'd like want this to be like woke or, you know, like I said, like Lash's homophobic tirade is really funny to me, because it fits that character, but like it does feel of its time where it's like this kind of like fear and terror over this gay panic does feel like culture has just like picked up a little bit, you know. But this is like recognizable to me as like a 20-year-old, you know. I kind of feel like I remember this being just kind of the general tenor of like talking about homosexuality for a really long time.
It feels kind of like
really
like,
shifted quickly.
Like, it feels kind of too roasting a hot tub 6 feet apart because they're not gay.
Oh, sorry, please, come on.
No, and like it's not fully gay, but it's like, isn't this gay though? Like when Lash goes into his whole tirade, like there's another character that's like, yeah, you better not say that because I'm not gay. And like he really insists on it in a way that's like,
Are they making a joke that he is something?
Yeah.
Well, then everyone calms down and like Lash is relaxed and they've moved past it, and then like there's a beat and then he's like, because seriously, I'm not gay.
Yeah.
like he's still not over it.
Like it's based in a way that it's like, it seems like there's a joke there, right? Like there's something there.
Well, I think maybe, you know, I think it's just kind of, like I said, like commenting on either their extreme discomfort with being labeled as gay, which, you know, right, like the idea of being terrified of anyone thinking you're gay is also kind of a weird form of homophobia, right? Like even if you are straight, if you're still just like, the idea that you would call me gay is so offensive to me, my core. So I think, like, you know, I kind of want to give it the credit for being, like, thoughtful about that. I think it kind of, like, gets into these, like, a bunch of potentially straight guys' psychologies who are all, you know, like, experiencing gay panic. Although, like, the thing that happens in the third book is they meet a little gnome who's just, like, an inch tall, maybe. And he's like, I'll guide you to, you know, like your lost companion. And he's like, but you have to do me a favor first. And they're like, all right, fine. What is it? And he's like, $30 and give me a hand job. And then they talk Lash into doing it. And Lash is like, but isn't that gay sex? And they're just like, no, just think about it as not gay sex and it'll be fine. He's like, okay. And then they just get this extremely funny, meticulously drawn Lash pinching his tiny little penis between his thumb and forefinger and jerking off. Tiny little gnome who's just like, oh, careful, don't tug too hard. Like, that whole bit really got me. And then he comes a little seed on the ground and he's like, one day a mighty oak will grow from that. So good.
Oh, that's so dumb. Oh. That's perfect. You also showed me a panel of like Lash's. He usually has like a huge face and like a huge head and like a kind of small face on that head. And there's like a pattern of his face shrinking and shrinking and shrinking on his head.
It's like, as he gets stoned, his face. Yeah. As he gets too stoned, his face just shrinks. And then he just starts speaking a made up language and no one can understand him for a while. And that, like, he does, I think he does a good job of getting kind of expressing some of the like too stoned feelings. Like that is not relatable. Like, you don't get too stoned and start speaking a made-up language. But Steven gets way too stoned, and then someone is like, hey, Steven, feed that spliff to Lash. And you just have a moment of, like, you see the word bubble literally enter his ear, and then in his brain, he goes, feed equals give, Lash equals Lash, spliff equals spliff, and he's just translating, like, feed that spliff to Lash as give that spliff to Lash. And then, like, he's like, oh, okay. And then he hands it to Lash. And, like, that kind of, like, extreme, like, trying to think through everything. And you have to actually, like, consciously translate in your head. Or, like, what are people saying to me? I was like, that's very relatable.
Yeah.
That was really good.
Oh, yeah.
Um, th- the thing that I actually love about this comic that I think really elevates for me, I think this book is gorgeous. I think this book looks so good. It is, it's all drawn on this, like, isometric point of view, right? So, like, a lot of shots from above, except for the characters. The characters don't exist necessarily on, like, an XY plane, but a lot of the, like, landscape is drawn very isometric. And then just the, like, the deep inking of this, like, the thick lines for everything, the, like, the landscapes and the action scenes, I think are just, like, it looks so good. It was such, like, a pleasure to read this.
Yeah.
Even when I was, like, just kind of into the story, but not, like, blown away by it, I was just, like, basking in this art. I really, really loved this art. And I feel like, you know, this is the, like, Love and Rockets influence a little bit. I don't know if it's directly that. I think it's actually pretty video game influenced with that, like, isometric point of view. But the, like, the black and white really perfectly illustrated, like, just extremely tight illustrations for everything. And everything's so, like, clean and clear and cohesive. And, like, movement is very, like, pretty minimal. But when it happens, it's, like, very clearly drawn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, like, in love with the look of this book. Yeah, I hope Joe Daly is still doing comics, because it kind of seems like maybe not. They seem like they had a couple hits, but this might be the last thing they've done. So, a little bummed if that's the case. They have a French a publisher, or they did, L'Association.
Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah, like, that's what I was saying earlier, and I was like, damn, I should have bought the French edition and read it that way. But I'll probably try to find a French version of it and, yeah, read that way.
Yeah, I read this on, oh, yeah, well, at this point, it's a little late, but if you're listening and you're curious, it is on Comixology Unlimited, so you can get, like, I got a free month trial of that, and that's how I read it. But then, like, the actual used copies of this are like $2 on Amazon, so I'm gonna go get all three of these, because I think I can get all three for less than $20. So again, I was surprised that this one, where I wasn't planning on, like, I specifically didn't buy this on purpose, because I was like, I've read this, I don't think I'm gonna want to own it, and now I'm like, I really want to, I just because I want to look at it again. I think it just looks so cool.
Yeah.
Any more Dungeon Quest thoughts before we jump into probably, like, the main course of this?
Nope. Yeah, looks good. Sounds fun. Hope there's a fourth one. Yeah.
Looks good, sounds fun.
I mean, I like the parts I haven't read sound fun, right?
yeah, sure. It's just funny conclusion.
Yep.
Megmog and Owl is,
yes,
it's not really a series necessarily, right? Like, Simon Hanselman is the creator, Australian creator, who has been doing this in these collections, I think, and then eventually, I think, got really big during COVID with shifting Megmog and Owl into, like, the context of COVID, and we'll talk about that, because that's kind of its own little notable moment for the comic. But Megmog and Owl overall, I think, it looks like they were, like, in a newspaper of comics, and then it was published online, and oh, it's Vice, that's right, I forgot about this, sorry. Yeah, Vice was publishing this as, like, a weekly comic, and then, like, Fantagraphics put out the collections. The way to read it is the collections, starting with, like, Mega Hex, and you can find a list on Wikipedia of all the stuff, but I only put Mega Hex on the list, but I read everything. I read Mega Hex, Amsterdam, One More Year, Bad Gateway, Seeds and Stems, and Crisis Zone, and Below Ambition. I read all these because I am in love with this comic. Like, I absolutely adore this comic. It is generally small, like, sometimes 1 to 2 page stories, sometimes extending out into larger stories. The mode of it varies, so, like, sometimes it feels like an actual issue of a comic, sometimes it's 20 pages is 20 separate stories. So a multi-format comic, different like styles, which I think is nice. I think they get to work both in, like, long form and short form, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
To see a comic like that exists in both forms. It is mainly about the three main characters, Meg, Mog, and Owl. Meg's a witch, Mog's a cat, Owl's an owl. Often Werewolf Jones should honestly just be
the fourth main character.
Werewolf Jones becomes the fourth main character by, like, the second or third book. You also read, like, the whole thing, right?
I read the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. It is about them living a, I'd say, an upper, lower class life. They are impoverished, but not in total destitution. I think that's kind of an important distinction, that this is a very specific kind of poverty. But it is a comedy comic about them being mean or ashamed or just the misadventures of a bunch of slackers in their who are increasingly getting too old to still be a bunch of slackers. I think that's the sadness often at the root of this, is that they're all getting they're all a little too old, and Werewolf Jones is especially, well, actually they all went to high school together, we find out at some point, I think. So they're actually all about the same age. So it does feel like Werewolf Jones might be.
Which I don't know if they say what age they are. Because it definitely feels like Meg and Alf are mid-20s. And then Werewolf Jones feels more like he's well into his 30s. So yeah, it's not.
I'm fairly maybe sure.
Maybe late 20s, early 30s.
I think it's they're all late 20s, early 30s. I think Meg's pushing 30.
Yeah.
Which is what I mean. This is what I kept feeling the despair of this comic, reading this and being thank God that I don't live in this lifestyle much anymore.
Yeah.
Not much anymore. I don't. But because, you know, the kind of just very permastoned hot couch lifestyle, I think is the hot couch is the term for this. Have you heard this?
No. I know couch potato, but I don't know what a hot couch is.
It's kind of just being stoned and glued to your couch for 6 hours playing, watching DVDs or, you know, playing the Wii or whatever, and just having
playing the
no
Wii
earthly
we do in 2023.
Specifically the Wii. Well, it is in this case. I just was rereading this and Werewolf Jones was making fun of Mog for not being able to play Zelda because he can't handle the, you know, the Joy-Cons because he has paws. So that's why that was in my head. I think at one point they actually get a Switch. So.
Because at the beginning of COVID, Meg is having crisis because she can't get Animal Crossing.
Yeah, and she needs Animal Crossing to distract her from life, and she's having a mental breakdown.
Yeah,
and it's very sad. Okay, so the comic is really funny, right? I laugh at this comic a lot. I think Simon Hanselman has this way of drawing faces, these flat affects of people, or the capturing these single simple moments of expression that just as reactions, really funny to me.
Yeah.
One of the funniest examples of that is Werewolf Jones, who's just a lunatic all the time, is causing havoc constantly, violence and havoc, and during the crisis zone, he kills 35 people in his weird COVID OnlyFans sex dungeon. And but anytime Owl specifically calls him out for being out of control, he'll get this, he either gets righteously indignant, which I think is really funny, if Owl calls him out for, you know, creating a OnlyFans sex dungeon that's a fire hazard, he'll be he'll call him out for being, you know, not being sex positive.
Yeah.
I think it's really funny whenever he casts somebody else as just not being woke because they don't like what he's doing, that always really works. Or he just gets his feelings hurt, which is so funny. They go camping together and Werewolf Jones is talking about some angel dust laced spliff he created for them to smoke, and he's talking about it, and he's I call it the fuckster, and Owl's you name it after yourself, and then there's just a panel of Werewolf Jones with his mouth hanging open, just shocked that Owl would be so mean to him. And it's literally the last comic he tried to fake rape Owl. You know, but that is a bridge too far for
I mean
him.
That's that the whole, that's actually the really whole thing of Owl, is anytime he does the even slightly mean or even just protesting against any of the other characters, react as if he's incredibly offensive and mean to them, when they're
absolutely unreasonable.
Yeah, exactly. Where the rest of the time they're the worst people on earth to him. And
I'll say, the beginning of it, they're meaner. I think that tones down slightly. I was actually surprised because I was rereading Mega Hex, the first one, and I was they're a little more sociopathic at the beginning, especially Meg and Mog.
Especially Meghan Markle, I think it gets transposed to Werewolf, to Wealth Jones afterwards.
Yeah.
They're still a-holes, but like most of the thing where like Owl's life is getting ruined is because of like, Werewolf Jones.
And he's getting rimmed by a dog in the yard. He's passed out unconscious, getting rimmed, while Meghan Markle sit inside and laugh at him.
Yep.
that was something at the beginning. Yep. Or like, I can't remember, they're out by the ocean and then Owl falls over and bonks his head, and then they put him in a grocery cart and wheel him through a fast food thing, and then he wheels and falls in front of some cops who then like beat him and arrest him, and they're like, oh, I wonder where Owl is. I guess we should just go home and watch some DVDs.
I
think the big story in the first volume that's going to stick out to people is the, like I mentioned, the fake rape of Owl. I mean, fake in quotes, because they do sexually assault the man. They throw him a birthday surprise. The Owl.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah. I don't know why I said that. Of Owl. They throw him a birthday surprise and they bring him to, I think it's Mike's house, which is strange, in an empty room. And I just reread this. It made me laugh really hard. They're like, surprise. And then Mog is like, we're going to do you. Quote, unquote, do you. And then it's just the three of them staring blankly at him. And then, like, joke punching him, like, knocking the air out of his stomach. And then rubbing, like, werewolves rubbing his flaccid dick on Owl while he holds him down. And Owl's clearly, like, traumatized and crying through this.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets like scary and terrifying and like mean, and then this is like the turning point of the comic where Owl, the epilogue, Owl is like, I don't forgive you, you guys raped me. And then Meg says, Owl, don't say that, that makes us sound awful.
Yeah.
That line made me makes me laugh so hard, where they're just so out to lunch, they're so like delusional about their relationship and how they're behaving, and they have just no connection to the real world or like consequences of other people, that like the idea that they just did something incredibly fucked up is just mystifying to them.
Yeah.
But then the kicker of that story is that Owl, they're like, we're sorry, Owl, we like you, you're our friend, we bought you a video game and an ounce of weed. And Owl immediately shifts from being like, I don't forgive you, like you raped me, to like, oh my god, you guys are my best friends. And that
literally the only time in the comic where they do anything actually nice for him.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and the fact that he's so, like, beaten down by them, that turns him around completely, and he's, like, crying with happiness.
Yeah.
At that extremely basic act of friendship is so, it's so, so sad, but it also makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Like, it, and then, like, the shot of them on the couch where they're like, nice puzzle solving, Owl. And he's just, like, the happiest he's ever been in his life. And then, like, that's just followed up by him being like, I'm bringing a new girl over. She's a cop, so please be cool. Don't smoke weed. And then they set him up where she just arrests him and then apologizes to Meg for, like, ruining her night. So, like, yeah, all that stuff really gets me.
Yeah, I mean, before Wealth Jones becomes a more important character, like, 75% of the comic is Meghan Mug ruining Owl's life without realizing it, and without like for them it's just like being normal people, and to him it's like, you absolute like horrible people. And like, to be clear, Owl is a terrible person as well. Like, he has sex with a 12-year-old at some point at the beginning.
That's right.
He's terrible, but like in a sad way. when he realizes how terrible he is, he's like, oh no, what did I do? But like, he still did it. He's still a horrible person.
He has some remnant. I mean, I think the comic actually really picks up in the like second and third volume when it starts to kind of dig into all their psychologies a little bit. I think when Meg starts dealing more with like her depression and her like anxiety over becoming just like her mother, the like background stuff with her mother, I think is really affecting. And then like Mog and her relationship crumbling, and Mog's like clinginess to her, but it's just because she's so awful to him, and then like cheating on him with Booger, who comes in. Booger's a great character. I think like that added texture to all the characters really works. I like the beginning volume of this. Like, I think it's really funny, but I think once they just stop being all Werewolf Jones, basically, and you leave Werewolf Jones to be the only Werewolf Jones, it gets better. And even Werewolf Jones gets, like, he's clearly the worst of them, and he's just terrible, but, like, once in a while has small redeeming moments. So I think, like, Simon Hanselman finds ways to find, like, at least make the characters understandable, if not...
Yeah. It would get, like, very tiring if it was just nonstop jokes about terrible people being terrible to each other. Like, it stays sustainable but by having those, like, shining moments of them being real people and, like, going through real shits.
It's not even redemption. It's just, no, like, it's just recognition, like, of something.
Them.
Yeah.
Running them and so making us able to, like, relate to them at least in, like, a small portion of their lives, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And
I mean, I related to this book.
Like, cliches and just, like, parodies of themselves.
I relate to this book a lot. I don't know, like, what that says, but, like, there's... Okay, the thing that I think makes this book transcendent to me, that I think makes this book really special in a way that I can't think of any other piece of art that has done this, is I think it gets this very... I think it understands this specific type of poverty really well, which is, like I said, not destitute. It is propped up somewhat by, you know, like, people propped up by families and favors and the slimmest government support, right? That keeps them just out of absolute, like out of homelessness, I guess, right? But just subsisting, like, just enough. I think it really, really understands that kind of a lifestyle and how miserable that is. And I think it really, I think it's really well observed in a ton of details about that. So, like, there's an example that comes to mind is there's a moment where Meg breaks a tooth out of nowhere. She's just minding her own business and a tooth shatters in the back of her mouth because she probably doesn't have real dental care because she doesn't have a job. And she immediately, like, it's sad and it's like anxiety inducing because she just immediately has, like, a breakdown, like a mental breakdown over this, because, like, what is she going to do about this? She doesn't have any money to deal with this. It hurts and it is, you know, not aesthetic and whatever, like, all the reasons that you just, it's miserable when you have something go wrong with your body. You can't do anything about it. She just breaks down, and I didn't remember, it might be Owl, I think, scrapes together some money for her and gives her, like, $400 to go to, like, the emergency dental clinic. And then she leaves, and then she comes back, like, an hour later and had bought, like, an Xbox One or something with the money. Which I think is really funny to just as, like, you know, she had this breakdown, Owl did this really nice thing for her, and then she just blew it on some video games. But also, I think that speaks so clearly to the psychology of being stuck in that poverty. I think that kind of idea of, like, yeah, I could go to the dentist now, but then my tooth's gonna break again tomorrow and then I'm fucked. I have no options. I have no way out of this. And that understanding of, like, that kind of immediate not nihilism, the hedonism. Yeah. That, like, hedonism that kind of comes paired with this unescapable poverty, because I might as well have some fun now because I'm so fucked. There's absolutely no, like, I'm not even going to attempt to get out of this because every time I do, I get totally shot down.
Even, like, their unwillingness to get a job, and, like, Al constantly pestering them to get a job because he pays most of the money for their apartment and everything, and, like, they don't want to, and, like, it's because they're lazy and they don't want to do anything other than just sit around and watch TV. But it's also, like, yeah, what's gonna happen if they get a job? They're just, like, gonna be, like, spending their whole time at, like, a terrible job and being miserable and still win barely enough money to get by, right? It's so, like,
yeah, they're gonna be making the same amount that they're just barely making on unemployment,
exactly,
but also now miserable because those systems all keep you trapped, right? Like, I think this really gets that. I mean, I have seen that a million times of, like, your unemployment is, you don't have a job option. And it's like, why would I struggle to get off of unemployment to go work at, like, Dollar General for 40 hours a week and make the same amount of money I'm making right now? And it's like, yeah, of course. Like, why wouldn't you? But then, you know, you get stuck there, right? And, like, Yeah, anyway, so I mean, it has that combination of that and like Meg's anxiety, I think, like actual, like, you know, like anxiety disorder, and all these things converging. I think like it really lands in that without being judgmental and without, like, it feels like a miserable, like, despairing experience, but it's done with a light touch that doesn't, like, damn the characters just for being, like, I'm just trying to think of, like, other stoners portrayed like this in media, and it's always just, like, they're always just portrayed as, like, a bunch of lazy burnouts, kind of, you know, and I think this kind of gets at some of the, like, larger societal stuff that, like, traps you there, and also the, like, psychology of why you would get trapped there, right, and, like, how easy it is, because it is, it's really easy, and I know people, like, who are still kind of in this lifestyle that I, like, thank God, broke out of, but like it's luck for a lot of time, right? It's luck and privilege that get you out of it. So I think like this kind of poverty, I just don't see it portrayed that much in media, the kind of like just getting by enough to like exist.
That's really interesting, because I think why something that could have easily made me not like this if I felt like the characters were not cliches, but like became empty, right? Became hollow. And I think anchoring them in like still having them be absolutely terrible, but anchoring them in like a more real experience, an experience of like very real people, especially like right now. Because it's, I don't remember when the first comic started, but it's like in the last 10 years, right? Even less so. I can't remember when the
first about 10 years ago. Yeah. I think 2013 is when they started. So yeah,
so it's like 10 years old. It's quite recent. It's like it's you like it's people you meet every day, right? Or that you know in people, your friends and everything. So like it's very successful at balancing their awfulness and their realness, because they're often awful in not unrealistic, but like exaggerated ways, and like there's a bit of like real people behave kind of like that, but like not to this point. This is insane.
Of course, it's heightened, but there is a grounding in some sense of reality that keeps it from just being like prison pit, right? And like it's not
And I think also because it's like mostly, for the most part, except for Crisis Zone, it's mostly like one or two pages gags, and like they're all part of like jokes, and they're all part of like the same timeline, like canon, and some of them have repercussions on the others, but like they are like one of jokes where you're like, well, this isn't gonna matter, even though like realistically it should, right? So you can like just take a step back and like not, when a joke happens of like a terrible thing happening to those characters, you don't have to like wallow in it. You can just go to the next page and it's a new story.
Yeah, right. And you're on to the new story. Yeah.
Which I mean, I kind of want to segue into Crisis Zone, because that's the the web comic version of this that happened during COVID, where like it tells a continuous story of the characters of Meg Morgan Owl during COVID. And I think,
how did this get on Instagram? Because I'm pretty sure this has got big on Instagram.
Yeah,
but like I was reading it and I was like, this is just as dick filled as anything.
Yeah,
I mean, anyway, no. Sorry, that's it.
No, that's fair,
anyway,
that's
go on, sorry.
And I think, to me, Crisis Zone is the version of this that doesn't work, at least doesn't work for me, because I think it just, because it doesn't get that break of like going to the next joke. Like a joke that happens in page 2 continues and has repercussions until like page 150. And none of the jokes are funny enough to sustain that. I guess the rhythm doesn't work for that. And to me, it got in a lot of times for a lot of jokes kind of exhausting. The best way I could describe it is, if BoJack Horseman got like 30 seasons and like become a parody of itself, that's kind of like what Crisis Zone feels to me. What do you think about Crisis Zone?
Crisis Zone. Okay, so I think Crisis Zone, because it blew up, it went a little viral.
Yeah.
Right. In like the individual comics, like when I've talked to people about this, someone like Tiffany Babb told me, she was like, "Oh yeah, Simon Hanselman, like that comic went really big. It was like huge during COVID because it was about COVID at the time." And I kind of get that, but at the same time, after having read like 6 volumes of this stuff and then Crisis Zone, I think it is, it's a bummer when I hear someone like Dave was like, yeah, I've been meaning to check out Meg Mog and Owl. I have Crisis Zone sitting on my shelf. And I kept kind of being like, don't start with that. You know, like, I think Crisis Zone so is good. Amsterdam, I don't want to say. Yeah. Was it? I'm pretty sure it was.
No, I'm saying like, if someone was asking me where should I start with Meg Mog and Owl, I'd say Amsterdam.
Sure.
Because like, it feels like when then you can... Hansel Mann like is getting more into the groove of what Meg Mog and Owl is.
Sure.
And it's before like... Starting with Crisis Zone doesn't.
And then you can go back to Mega Hex if you want to read. Like, Mega Hex is full of great jokes, but I agree. Yeah, so Crisis Zone, I think, works the least for me. I still enjoyed it, and I liked, like, there's a lot that I find funny about it. But, yeah, I think that kind of, like, the specificity of rooting it in, it's weird, because I think it gets at the feeling of those, like, 6 months in lockdown better than any other piece of media I've seen since, right? And I'm sure we'll see more of that as time goes on. But, like, it really kind of captures that feeling for me of being, like, stuck at home. But at the same time, yeah, that kind of, like, unrelenting nature. I mean, some of it's, like, I think Werewolf Jones, like, his hustle culture can't give myself a day off or an hour off attitude towards streaming on OnlyFans is so funny. That really works for me, where he's just like so exasperated and exhausted, and everybody is like, Werewolf, like, you have to stop this, and he's just like desperately trying to find the new thing to stick in his ass that will like get more donations, and like no one else wants him to do this, but he's talking about it like he's the breadwinner and he just has to keep finding, like,
and then jumping, like,
you think
from
my
that...
asshole wants this, like...
Yeah, and then jumping from that to when that stops working, and or when he gets tired of that, I don't remember, he jumps to like doing an Alex Jones, like Jordan Peterson style YouTube channel of misinformation and like anti-vax kind of stuff, which, like, yeah, that's very funny that he's like he has no morals whatsoever, but it's like funny to have him do all of those completely contrary things and then be like, when his like kid comes out, or like supposedly comes out as queer, he's like, oh my god, this is the best day ever, like, and shaming everyone who's not queer on him.
Like, yes, I mean, his kids, god, what are their names? Jackson
and
Axel, something like that. Javon and Axel.
I think there's Jackson, and the other one is like CD or something, so I don't remember. Yeah,
his relationship with his kids were like oftentimes like he's either extremely supportive of them, but in really stupid surface level ways where it's like they're just like, we haven't eaten in 3 days. We live in the trash can. But then he's also just like trying to support their, you know, like expression of sexuality. And then, you know, it's like they keep, I don't know, humping teachers or whatever. And Owl's like, your kids are out of control. And he's like, oh, is it because you're homophobic, Owl? Like that kind of him taking them to like the prom or something. And he's just like, I certainly hope there's no pedophiles at the prom tonight because you two are looking fuckable.
That's not even that. That's like he's taking them to like a beauty pageant and pretending they're both girls when they're both boys at this point.
That's like him being supportive of them.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
He's so funny. He's insane. Okay. But I do agree about Crisis Zone. I think it being rooted in that extremely specific time and place works less than kind of just like the general, you know, like mid-2000s feel of the rest of it.
Yeah.
I think, and maybe it is that thing where it is less of like, you know, small segmented jokes that led up and more these big prolonged stories, but I agree. So like if your experience of this comic has been Crisis Zone, I would give another thing a shot. I do wonder what I don't think I read, maybe I did read Below Ambition, I'm not sure, which is the post Crisis Zone, so maybe
I read it, but at that point I was definitely like kind of getting tired of it, especially post Crisis Zone, so I kind of skimmed through it, to be honest, but it's more
I read
focused
this actually
on just Meg and Werewolf going on tour.
Oh, maybe I didn't read this. I'll have to check it out. I actually, like, I didn't read this for the podcast because I discovered this like when I was making the list 4 months ago or something.
Yeah.
So I read these like over the course of 2 months. So I gave myself like plenty of time to slowly absorb these. But yeah, I love this comic. I think it like gets at something really, at least for me, like deeply relatable and like I said, very Again, I just have the feeling, like, a pit of despair in my stomach, or at least, like, anxiety. It makes me really anxious. It's really strange, but, like, it makes me just start picturing what my life would be if I hadn't, like, I don't know. I just think of any number of choices that led me, like, out of this kind of a life and into something a little more stable and, you know, put together. And I'm just like, oh, my God, what if that didn't happen? What if I didn't, you know, get into college? What if I didn't get I got laid off of a job that then spurred me to, like, go back to college. But, like, what if I didn't get laid off and go to college and then I just kind of stayed in that job and then, like, oh, my God. You know, like, it gets me thinking about that because, like, I kind of just I can relate to this lifestyle.
Yep.
Reading Dungeon Quest, though, I appreciated the Dungeon Quest. Because after this, I was just like, I'm never touching weed again in my life. It destroys your whole life. Like, it will just absolutely destroy everything. Yeah. And then Dungeon Quest, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember. Like, weed used to also be fun. Like,
well, yeah, and I don't think Meg Mugnell is like, oh, weed is what's making them be terrible people. Like, first of all, they don't just do weed. Like, I think, I don't even know if they do weed once. Like, they do a lot of other stuff.
Oh, yeah, they're smoking. I think, like, the second comic, they go to the ocean and then they do a gravity bong, like,
yeah, that's true.
In the tide.
But, like, most times when they're taking stuff, it's not weed. It's like, whatever crazy shit werewolf has cooked up or something.
He's just like, I found some ketamine on the street.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he's like, yeah, that's true. I don't know. It's to me, yeah.
That's not
I
relatable.
Definitely
to me.
See what you I see. Was... I definitely see what you're saying. Well, like Dragon Quest is like that fun fitting of like smoking with your friends. Like Meg Morganell is like just crazy people who happen to be stoners, right?
Well, it's you know, the weed here is clearly an escape, right? The weed is,
yeah,
and that's part of what I'm saying. Like, it kind of gets at that, like. There's 1,000 flavors of this, right? But, like, poverty leads you to all kinds of dangerous self-destructive behavior because you have that, like, that feeling of helplessness is real. That feeling of, like, you know, anything I can do to escape this mentally, right? That's why people get, you know, oftentimes get sucked into this, like, drug addiction.
Yeah.
And this kind of gets that, right? Like, they're all, I mean, God, there's a moment here where they can't get any weed. There's, like, a drought in town, and the desperation of them going place to place to place to place, trying to find weed and doing anything for weed. I was like, boy, I remember that. I remember those days of like, there's no weed in town and like spending the day trying to find weed and like how sad that is to think about in retrospect.
Yeah.
Of just like, why not just not get high that day? That's fine. But like, not a possibility when you're, you know, like in that mindset.
And like that getting tied to Meg having to sell her like, old like roller skates that her mom gave her and that like are pretty important to her, but like just setting that for like $3 to try and buy some weed
for like a toke of what turns out to not even like be weed, I think, right? It's some
I think they don't even manage
stems or something,
to get the weed guy, because like I think they wait for the weed guy, like
they end up huffing glue or paint or something
I think they're waiting for their dealer like for a while at the restaurant and then he never comes, so they go back home miserable and like do something else, and then the guy calls them like, I'm at the restaurant, what are you doing? And they're like, no, we bought something else with our money. And like, yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. So like,
it's funny and sad.
I love this comic. Love being a stoner. I'm getting back into it.
I mean, I'm curious about checking out the next one that's, I think, coming out this year. Meg's Coven, I think.
Okay. I have not read that yet. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's out yet.
I think it's
coming out this year. And I like it. Yeah, I'm curious. I definitely liked most. I think Crisis Zone is the only one where I was like, okay, that's too much. But the rest of it was like, let me like pace yourself. Don't read this all in one go. Like even more than anything else we've read so far, like just pace yourself out. It's not meant to be read all in one go.
It's very easy to like pick up and just read, you know, 10 pages of, and then like, I just read it before bed most nights and I just read as much as, you know, some of it goes down real easy and some of it takes longer.
I mean, honestly, I think it's a really good comic to like just read, like leave in your bathroom and read while you're on the toilet.
I was about to say the same thing. It's kind of a good bathroom comic. I will be like I bought Mega Hex. I'm gonna slowly like collect these, and I'm sure I'll just buy everything that they do from now on because I'm really fascinated by this. The Hanselman, I don't know that much about. They seem like an interesting person. They I got like, boy, who did I? Someone was like warning me that they're cancelable because they support somebody else who supports somebody who's cancelable.
Do they support JFK's son?
They do support JFK's.
No, that's Mark Miller. Is that King?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't. I couldn't parse it. I got warned.
And like the politics and, that like kind of like peek through in the comic is like, everyone sucks and everything is extremes that suck, and everyone that tells me that I suck for thinking that suck.
Like, I will say there is somewhat of a streak of, you know, like, it doesn't feel, especially in comparison to like everything else we've read, it feels like the most literally, I think this feels the most at ease with like gender and sexuality of anything we've read, where like there's tons of homophobic and transphobic stuff happening, but it feels the most like familiar and comfortable talking about it in a like it gets it kind of a way, rather than like it's an outsider looking in, you know?
Yeah.
So like when, you know, we joke about the Werewolf Jones stuff, but it does feel like it comes from a place of somebody who, you know, like at least understands the issues.
Play. It's like, definitely I don't a comic where everyone is both queer and homophobic at the same time.
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Charlotte. I'm really glad that I have to stop saying this at some point.
You've said that for every episode of Fantagraphic so far. Yeah.
Well, I guess for Love and Rockets, Well, I was worried that you wouldn't vibe with it initially because of how it is tough to get into. Like, I didn't vibe with it at the very, very beginning. I think that's true of probably most people who pick it up for the first time.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit to get into. But, like, 8-Ball, I wasn't sure. And I think you and I actually landed similarly in 8-Ball, which is, like, appreciate it, but maybe not, like, over the moon about it. But these, I was, like, I wasn't sure if any of these would, like, cross a line for you. I know you're not, like, I don't know, precious about this stuff.
No. Really. But also, Ennis, like, there is also a bunch of stuff in there, like, could legitimately trigger someone, like, in the very, like, real way of, like,
for sure, yeah.
There's pretty repulsive stuff. So, like, yeah. It's very fair all if three anyone of them out there is like, yeah, I don't know if I want to read that. Like, that's really fair.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I guess maybe I could put a more explicit, like, content warning, but I did write, like, you know, don't buy all these, like, test them out because they're not to everyone's taste. All right, so next month we're going to be doing two comics, two big graphic novels that I don't know how thematically tied in they are to one another. They are just tied in because they both have the name Monster in their titles. Yep. So we're reading Emil Ferris's My Favorite Thing is Monsters, and we're going to read Barry Windsor Smith's Monsters. These are two like modern classics, graphic novels that I have not read. I don't really know too much about them. And I'm excited. I think we're going to have Tiffany Babb on for the episode. So
ooh, hell yeah.
That should be a good one. This is fun. The Fantagraphics thing. I'm like, this was a nice, Love and Rockets and 8-Balls were both like kind of meaty. I definitely don't want to say like eat your vegetables comics, but they definitely were not like snack food in the way that I think all three of these felt. These are not insubstantial comics. Like, I think we had plenty to talk about, but they were certainly like easier to read experiences. So I think this was actually a nice break in the middle of reading some like more heavy stuff. So, but next month back into some heavy stuff. And then we're going to do Black Hole, the graphic novel Black Hole paired with Dementia 21, which is like a comedy horror manga.
I'm really excited about Dementia 21. I'm craving some manga right now. I want to read some manga.
Really? Yeah. I've been reading a ton of manga lately. Yeah. It's so strange because I've been thinking about manga for this podcast, but I'm like, so many of the good series are so long.
Yeah.
They run for so long. And I'm like,
let's just do One Piece before it ends.
I don't know. I'm reading One Piece again and I'm like, I don't know. Do I want to talk about this?
Oh, no, I was kidding because like, we don't have time to read 100 volumes of One Piece before it ends, like, next year.
He keeps saying it's going to end next year. And that was like 10 years ago. So,
who knows? Yeah, I don't know.
Dementia 21 is pretty breezy, though, and I don't think there's actually that much of it. But yeah,
I know you said Dementia, but I heard Dimension 21, and I'm like, picturing the horror manga written by Ben and Lee Madigan.
Yeah, he should get back to writing comics, honestly.
I really hope they finish Strong Female Protagonists, because
you know, it's weird because I didn't feel like I needed more at the end of it. I kind of, but you know, I certainly would be excited.
I mean, yes, but also like, just I want to read the leveled up version where like they both have very much leveled up in their like creative skills in the meantime, I think. Like, mm-hmm, I just want to see them collaborate again, right? Like, that's
Maybe even on something new, more than like wrapping up that story. Totally. Yeah, it's a good point. Dementia 21 just came out in a beautiful new box set like 5 days ago of the whole thing in English.
So, well, jokes on you, because in France we have good manga editions earlier than you guys, so we already have
They had
that.
Two separate volumes that were out here before, but they did just put them out as a box set. I think it's actually just the same volumes, but now just in a little box.
But is it a hardcover, or is it like a weird little paper?
No, they're two like thick paperbacks in a box.
Yeah. Disappointing.
Disappointing. And then we're gonna wrap up with the
10 a.m. right, 10 p.m. right now.
Yes, Gilbert Hernandez's Love and Rockets is how we're gonna wrap things up, and then we'll be on to our next topic. I've been brainstorming for our next topic already. Charlotte, ooh, I expect you to bring your A game for the next topic, okay? Because you know what, I'm gonna call you out. I think you didn't last time. I think you.
Wow.
I think the night before you finished up the assignment. I think your categories.
All of you to assume
sports.
It wasn't the very morning before we recorded.
It was clear that it was sports, manga, fantasy, period, and I don't remember what the third thing was. But
Junji I don't Ito? Remember either. Junji Ito, maybe? So, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, looking forward to that. Thank you all for listening. Tell a friend, review us on Apple Podcast, back us on Patreon, My Marvelous Year. All those things. Music is by FM Skyline, and see you in the funny papers.
Oh my god, I've forgotten. See you in the funny papers.